Good evening, everybody, or good morning, or good afternoon, depending on your location, or on the very off chance, good noon, if it's that 1 minute out of the, however many minutes that would be in a day. I mean, 7 minutes got to be tens of thousands of minutes.
It's impossible to know. It's impossible to
know. It's definitely not a song from Rent would help.
Oh, wow. That's right. I forgot about that song from Rent, which, you know what? I feel
I think that's minutes in a
year,
though.
Credibility that I forgot it and Frank so clearly remembers it.
Yeah.
So, yes. So as I do the, well, now we need to break down the math on this, though. So you have 60 seconds in a minute times, you know, 60 minutes in an hour times 24. So it's 86,400 minutes. Is that's correct, right? Is that the Rent song?
That sounds right. No, the Rent song is 525,600 minutes. And that's in a year. So you could have taken that and divided by 365.
Yeah, Paul, you were you had one too many 260s in there. That was how many, that was like if someone
I was doing
was
seconds
joining
in
us,
a day. Okay. Yeah. So that's why we're
if someone was listening to this entire podcast in 1 second of noontime, that would be the answer.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. So yes. If you've tuned in, and I said that exactly at noon, there are approximately 60 seconds of the day where it would be noon. So there's about a 1 in 1,440 chance that, in fact, you turned in and good noon would have been the accurate greeting. So this is Buffalo Bills, maybe next year, the podcast where it only takes about 2 full minutes to say the actual name of the podcast.
I'm right, Paul. At the beginning of the intro, there was a chance it was noon. It's no longer noon.
No, no. Not. By now, if it was noon then, it's probably 1:15.
But the good news is that we've covered all the transplanetarial possibilities. We've gone across the entire, you know, slide of possible, however you want to identify your time. We feel like we've probably covered
right.
it.
If you're listening in New Brunswick or New Delhi, you know, we've got your time slot covered.
We're your home for long, rambling introductions that go nowhere.
Can you tell we don't have a lot?
Yeah, no. Do we have any New Delhian listeners? I've now begun to wonder. And is New Delhian the proper term? It most certainly could not be.
George Carlin, I'll let this go. But George Carlin used to do a bit where he would do the evening news. And he'd say, like, it's 3 o'clock in Los Angeles. It's 5 o'clock in Indiana. It's 6:27 in Baltimore. And it was just really funny because, you know, obviously.
Because he's George Carlin. Although right. you did see George Carlin toward the end of his career. And by that point, it was not. It was like seeing a quarterback past his prime, which, speaking of, why don't quarterbacks get past prime at, they say, 39 years old? Because I was watching a game on Sunday, and a quarterback, I believe, who should have been Carlin-esquely past his prime, seemed to perform quite well for the New England Football Club. By the way, I don't think you guys ever said your name. Again, I'm Paul.
No one cares.
All right.
Scott.
The other guy's Frank.
I refuse.
All right, Frank is deferring like a second half kickoff.
Right.
So, you know, looking at this this game, it was, I think we can all agree on one facet, an exciting game. It reminded me most closely, I would say, of the Patriots-Panthers Super Bowl, where it was scoreless for a long time, much longer than people expected, and then it became a scoring bonanza. Decided in exciting fashion at the end of the game. This was the only, as you've heard 5,000 times by now, overtime game in Super Bowl history, the only game which ended with a player crossing the plane into the end zone for a touchdown, ensuing a mass celebration, perhaps the football equivalent of a walk-off home run in the Major League Baseball World Series. So certainly a great level of excitement in this game. Many Buffalo fans, you know, obviously not thrilled with the result with yet another championship for Brady. We will get into our individual thoughts on that as we go. But, you know, well, I guess we'll start with Frank here. That is he who refuses to name himself. And, you know, just Frank, what are your general impressions on, you know, how things went in the game and what stood out to you? And did anything make you think about the Bills and where they're really lacking that will keep them from getting to this level? Just any thoughts.
I guess with that last point, I would say that the good news is it happens to everybody with New England. Like, Atlanta's a really good football team. I picked them to blow out New England, and I was only being a little facetious. And you know what? I was right up until I wasn't. It really was that game where they, like, all they had to do was, you know, be reasonable in the fourth quarter. They didn't even have to do anything like super spectacular. Atlanta just needed to be reasonable. And call a couple of running plays, or at least not deep drawbacks, or, you know,
set a couple of three and outs would have sufficed, frankly.
Right. And yeah, it's just sort of, you know, what they did some of the time. And it's stuff that I'm sure you, like the listeners, have heard all week, because this will be the most dissected football game in history. I mean, it was on the biggest stage, and it was the biggest collapse on the biggest stage. It was nearly the size of the Bills Oilers comeback, but, you know, even more so because of the quality of the teams and the stakes at play. I feel gut-wrenched for Atlanta. For me, I was very actively, happily rooting for Atlanta, and I was hopeful that, like, you know, they were going to drive the stake through the heart of New England. But much like Seattle 2 years ago, it comes down to one ridiculous, stupid decision. In Atlanta's case, a few more. That, you know, they had several opportunities. They had built themselves several opportunities into the game. I think that it highlights for me the annoying overtime rule, the fact that they never really fixed the overtime rule. It's a little sad that the Falcons never got to touch the football in overtime. They had, you know, like, you could talk about, well, they needed to get a stop and they had their chance to win it, but, like, at the end of 60 minutes, they had played just as well as the Patriots. It's just the Patriots had saved all their good play for the end, and the Falcons had done it all the first half. So they shouldn't be penalized, in my mind, at least from a narrative perspective, like, that, you know, they had their chance and didn't win it. They did have their chance and didn't win it. I just felt like in the overtime, it really highlighted the fact that, you know, Matt Ryan should have gotten the chance to march down the field with his team, because they still moved the ball a little. They just, you know, started getting stupid at the end. Look, this is a good New England football team. The rumor is Tom Brady wants to play at least 45. And I have no reason to think that at least the next – what? Like, there's any reason to think that next year he's not going to be just as good? I don't know. Like, it's a terrible state for the AFC. That's it. We're stuck. Yeah. This is it. It's going to be another year, and then I'll relinquish to Scott here. But it's going to be another year where you have to make the most of every game that's not New England, because those two games are losses. At least one of those two games is lost, and more often than not, the two is you're starting in an 0-2 hole, and you need 10 wins. You have to go 10-4. You know, you don't get to go 10-6. You have to go 10-4 in your other 14 games, and it's not fair, but it is what it is. And, you know, those are my thoughts on the Super Bowl.
No, I agree. I mean, I think Frank has been the one driving this train for almost as long as we've had this podcast, frankly, of, you know, it's hard to be too hard on the Bills because they play in the division with the Patriots. And as much as we've kind of hemmed and hawed and tried to, you know, find reasons that Brady wasn't the best, or that the Patriots weren't the best, or, you know, not give them, you know, respect for whatever reason, it was obviously massively evident at this point that he is the greatest quarterback of all time, that this is probably the greatest football dynasty of all time. And it's not, and therefore it does kind of put the Bills' struggles over the last, you know, 17 years in perspective, because obviously they've had to deal with the Patriots for a lot of that. Now, that said, doesn't let them completely off the hook. I mean, the Dolphins did make the freaking playoffs this year. And they got blown out in Pittsburgh, but that doesn't change the fact that they at least got in there and had a shot. And there's really no reason that couldn't happen to the Bills if they had some degree of competence over the last couple of years. Same thing with the Jets and half a dozen, you know, those are the only two other teams in the division. But and pretty much their entire rest of the conference.
If we want to go back to the early 2000s.
Yeah, exactly.
That's right. They were actually, when the run started at Patriots Super Bowls, the Colts were still in the division. Dear God, that's been a while.
Yeah. No, that's, I saw that on the other day, that I think it was actually a Buffalo Ramblings post, but it was LaDainian Tomlinson had his entire career retired and was inducted into the Hall of Fame in the matter of the time in which the Bills haven't made the playoffs.
He was drafted after the Bills last made the playoffs, and now he's going into the Hall of Fame.
Quick question. When did the Tom Brady era start? Was that 2002?
Tom Brady was 01 was his first year with the as a starter when I think he was drafted. Was he drafted in 2000? Was it? Was on the bench behind Bledsoe for a year?
Okay.
And then he won the Super Bowl, the first Super Bowl after 9/11, because I remember rooting for him.
Right.
Then.
Yeah, I was too.
The Rams were the favorite going in.
But he wasn't really the quarterback. he wasn't really the quarterback in 2001.
No, that was not in right. 2000.
In 2000, he was selected with the 199 pick. They thought he would draft in the second, third round. He was on the start of the season as the fourth string quarterback behind Drew Bledsoe, backups John Freeze and Michael Bishop. By season's end, he did make it up to number two behind Bledsoe.
So
his rookie season, he was 1 for 3 for 6 yards.
I'm just saying that he – so in 2001, the Dolphins and the Jets both made the wild card. But since then, the Jets have made it 4 times and the Dolphins have made it once as the wild card. Twice,
right?
The Jets have won the division. The Dolphins won the division once and the Jets won it in 2002. So we're talking 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I'm not going to count 2001. 5, 2008 is 6, 2002 is 7. So 7 times in 15 years has a team, in addition to the New England Patriots, made the playoffs.
Right, and no one, and of note, in the Patriots division, that's an automatic loss every year. No team has swept the Patriots during the Brady era.
Right.
No NFC East team.
Right, 2002 was the weird year where everybody was 9-7 except for the Bills, who were 8-8, and so the Jets won on like a series of tiebreakers. And 2008 was the Matt Cassel year, and so you know, really, we're talking 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 times. Like we made the wild card as a division, and I don't know. I mean, it's like
I'm trying to agree with you.
I'm not trying
to defeat my point yet again.
No, I'm not disagreeing with you. I just really want to drive home like just how tough it is to make the playoffs.
That's the thing though. But again, it's not impossible. It can be done. It has been done repeatedly over the last 15 years, and we have not done it. And I think we would definitely say that we were the most incompetent of those three teams this entire time.
Yes.
So that is probably, those two things are in fact linked, as is the Brady thing.
Yes.
So anyway, the game was terrible the game was awesome until it was terrible. We had a very amusing text chain, which I was reading again today. all of us like kind of slowly panicking as the game turned in the fourth quarter, and then the all kind of gradual realization that this is turning into every freaking New England Patriots game that we've ever watched. Will you leave that one?
I actually had a text queued up that I did not send when in the midst of it all, being like, I'm gonna screenshot all these and save them so we can talk about them after the Falcons win, just to show how much we panicked. And I thought, you know what, maybe I shouldn't send this because maybe the Falcons won't win.
Yeah. No, I definitely, and that's the thing, I was definitely trying to avoid holding on. I was holding out on the Falcons are choking texts until it became completely obvious that they already were. Like, I was like, no, they're going to turn it around. No, they just got that first down. Oh, no, it was really, and that was the thing. I mean, and everyone's pointed this out already, that one series after they had the big play action pass to Devontae Freeman and then the insane catch from Julio Jones. And then all they really needed to do was just run the ball up the middle 3 times and not turn it over and not take a sack or any penalties. And they could have kicked a field goal probably to win it.
They're averaging 9 yards a carry at that point, by the way, just to remind everyone.
And yet they cannot do anything. And there was a funny, and there was a good one on Deadspin too, of it was like the headlines as the night went on. It's like, over time, like, and the one they ended up settling on was the, you know, Tom Brady becomes greatest quarterback ever, America ruined, or something along those lines. But then it was a lot of like Golden State's off the hook,
right?
You know, Tom Brady disproves the existence of God, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was a little sad. And of course, the frustrating thing was someone could have just told me the Patriots are going to win. I didn't need to watch the whole game that way.
Yeah.
But instead, I stayed around to try and hope the Falcons would get through it. And they just kept hanging around long enough to keep me interested. And of course, I came into work the next morning with like 4 hours of sleep. So screw you, Patriots, once again.
Yeah, screw you, Patriots. I think that accurately sums up my opinions on this game. You know, thinking about the let's go to that fateful last session. There was so much in this game I feel gets overwhelmed by that, but you know, honestly, you got to look at the plays that decide the game. The Patriots had made some crazy fourth downs, which many people did not give much credence to, and they happened because they're on the comeback trail. There was an onside kick. They had They'd had a pass pick that was run back for a pick six in the first half. So all that stuff happened. But let's focus on Julio Jones, second, phenomenal. Are you freaking kidding me? Catch of the day along the sidelines. It was just a thing of beauty. And then the first thing that happens is they try a run, they lose a yard. What they should have kept doing is trying more runs and losing a yard at a time on those, as Scott very well mentioned. Matt Bryant, 92% on field goal tries this year, 34 of 37. In case you're wondering, 40 to 49 yards. He was, I believe this percentage is 100%, 9 of 9. So if you gain 0 yards, you have a near, you know, perfect chance of him winning this game. Either the Patriots will have burned through their timeouts or 35 seconds apiece has come off the clock. And since he's going to make it, they're going to win the game. So really, two kneel downs even would have done enough. So right. it was just flabbergasting that Belichick seems to have this way of making teams overthink, because Belichick will always be saying, oh, you got to play to your strengths and you can't necessarily just run the ball because you've got a lead and so forth. But I have seen Belichick late in games be like, no, now we just run the ball, because now there's no way for them to catch us if we simply take time off the clock or make them burn their timeouts and kick a field goal. We have seen this strategy before when they beat the Bills in the E.J. Manuel's debut, the 2013 season opener. Same deal. Once they got into field goal range, and they were trailing, mind you, so this was a gutsy move if the kicker had missed the field goal. Said, nope, we're good. We're just going to keep running the ball, knowing the Bills can't do anything about it, and we'll bring it down to the last play of the game, and we'll kick a field goal and win it and go home. And that's exactly what they did. So the Falcons and you know, Kyle Shanahan was calling the plays, really overthought that, and that was frustrating. One thing, you know, Frank noted, you know, the Pats do this to everyone, not just the Bills. And so there's some comfort there, because I was thinking way back. I mean, there's the McKelvin fumble game. That was a victory, defeat from the jaws of victory Bills game. There was the Teddy Bruschi game way back in the late 20-aughts or early to mid 20-aughts. The game I attended in 2001, the first year of the Brady era, where the Bills, who finished 3-13 versus the eventual Super Bowl champion Patriots, took the game to overtime, forced a fumble, and recovered the fumble on the Patriots side of midfield, only for it to be ruled a dead ball, because while the fumble happened, Antoine Winfield hit the guy so hard, he knocked him unconscious. His head was lying on the out-of-bounds line while his foot was touching the ball. And like basketball, that's considered out-of-bounds. And then on the next play, Antoine Smith ran for 45 yards. I wish I were making that up. And then there were two games where the Bills went to the fourth quarter with a lead in 2011 and 2012 and lost each of those games by more than 28 points. So those are just some of the Bills ones. None of those will ever compete with what happened to the Falcons in this game. The Falcons will have to live this down on the biggest stage forever. And it also helps the Bills, because they are no longer going to be considered the biggest Super Bowl chokers on anyone's list for any of those teams. So
yeah,
this is true.
One thing Frank also noted, which I thought was interesting, the Dolphins and Jets' lack of success. He went through and actually statistically named all those things, so I really can kind of skip that segment. But and then Scott noted, as hard as, you know, Frank, he was trying to agree with Frank. Frank was making it difficult, but, you know, I think we all hit the same point. Yes, the Bills have been mediocre, and they have, you know, should have fielded some better teams over the years. At least the Dolphins and Jets have made some trips to the playoffs. But when you're given an automatic 1 to 2 losses a year just by virtue of the Patriots being in your division, it makes things difficult. The OT possession rules, there was some good back and forth with this on Twitter. I actually replied to a comment on Jerry Sullivan's wall, and I said,
"Do it on Jerry." Yeah.
Yeah. And I said,
"Well, I didn't have it." Yeah. I didn't see what happened to Jerry. This is good. This is
no. He said, "Jerry said great story, but I still think it's a joke that the league MVP didn't get a chance to counter in overtime. Need to change that rule." So I replied, "Up 25 with 20 minutes left. If you can't hold that lead, do you really deserve a chance?" So that was a take. And then Ryan, longtime listener Ryan, noted that to Jerry and I, two things have absolutely nothing to do with one another, ? And he's right. So I said, fair enough. But in context, I am simply saying I don't feel bad for the Falcons. They blew so many chances to win that game that this was the one instance where I think if you're going to have a Super Bowl where a team scores the touchdown winning possession on the first possession, and the other team's offense doesn't get a chance to win, it should be this type of game where a 25-point lead is blown and you cannot really feel badly for New England, for, you know, or for the Falcons for, you know, their shortcomings in my mind. But it is a rule that's is also worth looking into changing, because it happened now in the Super Bowl, in the very first ever Super Bowl overtime game. So I, as we said at the outset, I think we all agree, you know, this was a really exciting game. It did screw up Scott's sleep, and we are forever hating that fact of this matter. But, you know, overall, at least it was entertaining. And before we get to three stars, you know, I just want to make an observation. If you guys want to tag on to it, great. If not, we'll move on in discussion. But I found, compared to all of the other Patriots Super Bowl wins, I find myself getting more numb to them, because what really can you do to get upset? It is now well established that Tom Brady is the greatest quarterback of all time. I am prepared to defend any argument that says otherwise.
Well, you should have called into Mike Shope's radio show on Monday, because he was not prepared to say that, and he was being a goddamn idiot about it. He just felt like he had to take – he didn't even really take the position that, like, somebody else was the greatest of all time. He just was like, I'm open to the idea that it could be someone else. And it's like, he did this like half-ass scarecrow. Sorry, I know you. He did this half-ass scarecrow that really annoyed me. Like, just sort of like, well, it's
straw man,
right? You need to sort of, you know, explain to me why he's the greatest. It's like, shut the fuck up.
Yeah.
If you don't think he's the greatest, it's your job to tell me why he's not, because all the baseline empirical evidence is there. And a matter of fact, part of that better be, this is who is the greatest, because, you know, if you're going to say he's not, you better have a good answer as to who is.
It's a finite list.
Right.
There is no infinite amount of other quarterbacks it could be. There's a finite number of quarterbacks.
Right. And it's not any of the other ones.
And if Shope, and I'm glad you, I didn't hear that, and I'm glad you jumped in with that, but like, what metrics is Shope looking for? Individual accolades, team success? Individual success in the biggest game when you win four Super Bowl MVPs, longevity to win your first Super Bowl in 2001, win three others, and then win your most recent one after the 2016 season. I mean, there's no metric where, you know, he comes up short.
Do it without a cast of characters who's consistently better than the opposition.
Right. Yeah. He's like routinely in like the top 5 to 10 in a lot of statistical categories for passing. I mean, it's
he had arguably one of the greatest seasons in NFL history, like the 17-0 year. I forget what his numbers were, but that was
right.
Clearly,
and this season was nearly as good. And he did it short
in four left games
in 12 games.
I think he was near 3,000 yards mid season in 2008.
The thing is, like, I don't know who you're gonna hold him up against. I mean, you're gonna hold him up against Montana, who, like, has similar levels of accolades. Well, he has more accolades. You're going to hold him up against Peyton Manning, who has a lot more individual success, and you might say, okay, maybe we could still argue that Peyton Manning is a better passer or did special things. Like, I think, you know, I was listening to Jaworski talk about Manning, and he said that Manning changed how the quarterback position was played because he sort of had the whole offensive playbook in his head. But at the same token, you know, like, Manning was playing with guys like Marvin Harrison and Edgerrin James and, like, you know, managed to get two Super Bowls under his belt, God bless him, and go to three, and one of them wasn't even really his doing. His most recent one could have been a lot of quarterbacks. And yeah, so, definitely. You know, like, to the extent that this is a game about winning and winning the championship, I think that, like, that argument's gone. You can say that you might be able to say Manning was a better passer, but I don't think you can say he's a better quarterback.
I'm trying to think of who the Hall of Famers are on the Patriots offense the last 15 years, other than maybe Randy Moss.
Randy Moss, Chad Johnson, but like Chad Johnson.
Chad Johnson
even Chad might not even go.
Not if he is not in the Hall,
Gronk may or may not be based on his injury history and how the rest of his career goes.
Maybe. I could see Gronk making it just because he's the outsized personality that people like, and the injury history would be the one thing that stops him, but he's dominant enough to get there. But even then, he's been injured for half the freaking Super Bowls. So
right. So, yeah, anyway,
I don't want to talk about how good Tom Brady is anymore.
Yes, so I'm done with that. But I was just thinking that I really was relatively numb to this game because it's like, what did the Patriots prove by winning that they hadn't already proved? And how is it worse for us as Bills fans that they won yet again. If anything, it goes back to the arguments, you know, we were asserting earlier that this just shows how difficult the Bills' path has been, that much more difficult because they are trapped in this division with this dominant team. So while I was certainly rooting for the Falcons, I was not as angry as I found myself during past Patriots Super Bowl victories. I was simply thinking, well, they've already proven it all. They just proved one more thing. Meh. So I don't know if you guys were more upset by it than me, but I learned to live with it.
Yeah, I mean, I was more annoyed as it was happening.
Yes.
Than afterwards. Because it was afterwards, it was like, well, that's why they're the best team in history, and he's the best quarterback in history.
And I think if it happened the other way, where they blew out Atlanta, I wouldn't have been as invested to begin with. But I was really sort of invested because Atlanta had them on the ropes and looked great. And so it sucked me in. I think that, you know, heightened my sensitivity to it. But, I mean, as to them being champions, I mean, every year they don't win, they're in the AFC Championship. You know, it's rare that they're not within a game of winning the whole thing. So, you know.
Yep.
All right, let's be done with that.
Yeah, that last bit of Super Bowl talk is the usual. Scott, I'm sure you'll blow us away and surprise us with your three-star choices on this one.
Yes, no. So the honorable mention, and of course I have to bring him up because he's my boy, and I don't think we quite overlapped, but he attended the University of Wisconsin shortly after I did, where he started running back in a number of kind of two- and three-headed backfields before he ended up getting drafted in, I think, the fourth round by the Patriots, a Mr. James White, who ended up having 20 touches for about 149 yards, three touchdowns, and a two-point conversion, which makes him the highest-scoring player in history in the Super Bowl, which again is kind of, you know, scoring usually goes to the kickers because they're kicking the points, but no, it's James White now. So good for James. Third star is Bill Belichick. I don't really know how he did it or how he managed to get this third star, but I'm pretty sure he cheated to get it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that'll come out at some point, but until then he gets his third star. At your second star position, I'm putting Tom Brady, 43 of 62, 466 yards passing, two touchdowns.
Is that a Super Bowl record, Scott? I'm just curious.
I think it is.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. I think it's all the Super Bowl records, actually. sacked five times, but obviously the winning quarterback. And so you may be wondering, well, certainly if the two brightest offensive stars for New England are the, you know, second and third, or the second star and honorable mention, who could possibly be the first? Certainly not anyone on New England's defense, which was mostly torched the whole night. And you would be correct. It's not anyone's on New England's defense. It's not really on their offense either, but just kind of an ominous presence in the background that seems to undergird all of their victories, and is generally considered responsible for all of the evil in the world. And that is Satan. Lucifer,
the fallen morning angel, star. Yep.
The morning star, responsible for this game, like so many other Patriots games. He is your first star, he who shall not be named. And I'm not talking about Voldemort. So.
We really forgot to discuss his impact in this one. So that's our oversight. We are normally better than that, guys.
Oh boy, Super Bowl, man.
Yeah.
Well,
we've only got five more Super Bowls with the Patriots to look forward to, right? So just cross them off the list.
Yep. And now we get to deal with their fans for yet another season and just the fun and joy. And speaking of obnoxious a-holes, Rex Ryan, a couple weeks ago, you may have seen this story. He did not in any way diss the city of Buffalo or its people and talk about his time here. But he did send a literal big FU to the Bills organization and said that, well, he would not be rooting for the Bills, but he'll root for the Jets now again. This, I don't know about you guys, and we started with Frank last time, so I'll start with Scott this time. My reaction when I read this is it just made me all the happier that the Bills have parted ways with him, that he was so caught up in this delusion that, and don't get me wrong, the Bills organization is a dumpster fire, so we understand that. But, you know, for him to act like he had no responsibility and And all right, I guess I'm starting with this, but I briefly want to note that he had said that, you know, he set the expectations too high, saying they could be a playoff team. He took over a 9-7 damn team, and they didn't lose anyone except their starting quarterback, who, by the way, was Kyle Orton, and they improved that position. And he just made things where I'm going off. I haven't given Scott a chance to talk, so we'll let Scott start with this one. I'm gonna restrain.
No, I did read the article. Yeah, I mean, it was pretty surprising on some level. You know, we kind of knew that Rex was a guy who was not, I would say, introspective. Not a guy to kind of look, you know, kind of take a long weekend by himself. I mean, think about this. Think about Rex Ryan, like, going out into the woods somewhere and just kind of talking to himself and kind of getting his head right and thinking about something he could do to get better, and kind of being really introspective like that. Like, I don't see that happening. Like, I don't see him, like, taking time off after the Jets fired him or after this and being like, yeah, you know what? Maybe there were some things that I could have done different. Maybe I do need to really think about my defense. Maybe I have lost a step. Maybe I do need to, you know, cede some control to the front office or talk less to the media or focus more on game day preparation and less on, you know, I'm spending my time elsewhere. And it doesn't seem like something he's been doing. Like, Rex Ryan is a guy who kind of was that guy. He's kind of the guy who basically, I don't want to say he's like the guy who peaked in high school, except he didn't peak in high school. He peaked in 2000, whatever it was, those 2 years that he got to the AFC Championship, based off of a very aggressive blitzing defense that had, you know, slowed down Tom Brady a little bit. I don't want to say stopped him, but managed to get the Jets into those AFC Championship games. And then he kind of stopped evolving, trying to rest on those laurels, trying to put the genie back in the bottle, try and capture that genie again of that kind of moment of that team and that defense that he was running. And he never realized that the game had kind of kept going and that he didn't have the same players every time. And frankly, there wasn't enough time to waste putting that together in Buffalo, that he needed to be really, if he was going to go ahead and tear down the whole system, he needed to get started on it right away. He blew a season with this kind of half-pregnant defense idea of trying to kind of meld his system with the other system. And, you know, maybe I should give him more credit for at least trying it, but clearly he wasn't able to make it work. And then this season wasn't any better in terms of him trying to kind of be more successful. And it was clear that, you know, a lot of the players came out afterwards and basically said it was too complex and none of us got it. And yeah, I mean, maybe in theory it works, but, you know, in the real world, you have to kind of deal with the players you're dealt. And he said that, and that's, again, like one of the many things that one of the many lies that he frankly told, or the promises he broke was like, oh no, I'm a guy who will fit the players into the scheme, and it's the coach's job to find a scheme that fits the players. And that was never the case. So whatever, Rex.
Yeah, I got nothing to add. I don't care. He's an idiot. Right. And yep.
Be a good commentator.
Sure.
He will be, yes, he will have that going for him. So, you know, that's enough of Rex Ryan. And this will be the last time we probably talk about Rex Ryan on this podcast in the present tense of something he has been doing lately. Anyway, with that in our rearview mirror, speaking of washed up has-beens, Tony Romo has come up in discussion. So, you know,
Paul is nailing the transitions tonight.
I am on my segues. So this is, I say that half jokingly because I am not sold on Tony Romo. I do not think it's a bad option. Obviously, it will have to do with what the Bills decide to do with Tyrod, and don't you worry, we'll get to that. But I think when you're, and we'll start with Frank on this point, when you are the Buffalo Bills and you have struggled at the quarterback position, you are looking for answers, and you might find available someone who has proven successful at the NFL level, who's proven to be a winner at the NFL level, who would probably have been a starting quarterback on a playoff team this year if he had not suffered the injury bug and been replaced by a rookie who just would not cease catching on fire, who is just constantly flammable, which is a problem in every way, except in the figurative way, of course. So, you know, with all of that going on, you know, this is a guy who's potentially available out there. And so, mm-hmm. you know, we'll start with Frank. Frank, the Bills may be interested in Tony Romo. Would you be interested in Tony Romo?
Sure. I mean, I don't know. Like, he's, like you said, a good quarterback, probably. Has experience winning. It depends on what the price would be to either sign him or trade for him, which I'm assuming would be kind of steep because quarterbacks are rare commodities. To me, this is the Drew Bledsoe deal all over again, and I honestly didn't dislike the Drew Bledsoe deal. I thought it was a good idea to have a veteran that could take a team that had some talent and work with it in, while in the interim looking for the next quarterback who they thought was J.P. Lossman, and they missed. But to me, like, that blueprint isn't a terrible one. Football isn't hockey. You don't know that the guy you're drafting first overall is going to be a great player for the next 15 years like you do in hockey or, to a lesser extent, basketball. There's so many moving parts in football that, like, you have a – you know, what I'm trying to say is, like, you shouldn't – the option is to either pursue Taylor or Romo or one of these guys that could sort of secure a certain level of success for you, or to dive into the draft and roll the dice, as it were. And really, you could do belts and suspenders. My guess is that it's going to be too much. It's going to be either too much money or too much trade value, or both, to secure him, or just that Romo would rather play for a team that's a little closer to the playoffs, you know, or has a little clearer path to the Super Bowl. You know, why wouldn't you go to some place like Denver, where you theoretically wouldn't have to play New England until, you know, the final, you know, the AFC Championship game? You know, you'd have to put off that sort of competition for as long as possible. I don't know. I think that's kind of my thoughts on it.
I fundamentally agree with Frank, so I won't go on too long. But, yeah, I mean, I think the problem is that there is a value for Tony Romo on the Bills. And I would not, you know, love Tony Romo as a backup because, frankly, he'd be a great backup. He's a guy who's shown that he can win games. Yeah, he's a little fragile, but what are the odds that both the starting quarterback and the backup quarterback are going to get hurt in the great game in the same game? Oh, wait, we're the Bills. Happening. But just in theory, for another team, he might be a really good backup option with that in mind. However, obviously, he's not going to make backup money. He's not going to take backup money, and he doesn't want to be a backup. He wants to be a starter. If you told me he wanted to be the starter for my team, and did I want him as that? Yeah, I mean, I would say, sure, I'd think about it, but I'd be hard-pressed to franchise, you know, to sacrifice the future of the franchise for it. Now, the cap numbers are not great for him. Well, obviously, like, it's $19.6 million this year, and then $9 million next year and $3 million the year after that. I'd be eaten in the trade or whatever. But I think the problem is really the trade value, as Frank points out, in terms of what Dallas would want back. They can't get nothing back for him, I don't think. So they would almost certainly need something. And I'm not sure that whatever Tony Romo gives you is that much better than what Tyrod's gonna give you in terms of, like, big durability into the account. And so if you wanted to keep a quarterback of his value, you can just do that with Tyrod and only pay the money and not have to worry about the losing anything in the trade value. So I'd say probably not going to work out, but, you know, it's never stopped us for four. I mean, we've made plenty of terrible decisions, so why stop now?
Right. And Scott's not only referring to the three of us, but of course the Bills franchise. Mm-hmm. So, I'm of the mind, you know, it's all to me about the cost that would go into it in terms of not just the finances that Scott recognized, but the fact that, you know, Romo is not a free agent, so he would have to be cut, which Dallas will definitely do if he is on the roster. But I have a feeling that he will be traded in advance of that because, again, as Scott notes, there are so many quarterback-hungry teams. They will likely – for sure, make a move, make a better offer than Buffalo can, because I do not want Buffalo parting with a first-round pick or anything crazy for that, for a guy who might help your franchise for 1 to 3 seasons, most optimistically. So it all boils down to that for me. But as Frank said, why aren't you at least interested? You know, why not? you should definitely be interested in this guy. He brings a lot to a franchise. If you can navigate the competition, if you can get him at a reasonable price and he can be that transitional guy to whomever it is that you pick up in the draft, or a younger quarterback like a Tyrod Taylor, a Rob Johnson. I'm sorry, I'm bringing up these horrible names. The younger quarterbacks you pick up in a trade or through the draft and think that you're going to, they might take over that job permanently. Or if you decide to, you know, have Cardell in that mix too, thinking he's going to be part of it, I'm all for it. So I have no issue with Tony Romo. He improves your team immediately. He makes it competitive immediately. When you have the weapons he will have on offense with a good offensive line protecting him for the most part, with Charles Clay, with Sammy Watkins, and that running back, I can't remember his name. Oh, right, Mike Gillisley. Yeah. And also, of course, the great LeSean McCoy, who I mentioned last because he is really honestly the cornerstone piece. So I'm of the mind that the Bills should have an interest, but of course need to be very careful what they pay. So this all, of course, goes to, you know, Tyrod Taylor, who is spotted this week, and I have this as a discussion point, but we really have nothing to discuss about other than he was spotted working out in Buffalo. What might it mean? I think it simply means he is trying to show either the Bills that, hey, I'm committed to this, or potential suitors that, look, it's the day after the Super Bowl. I'm out here working out, trying to make myself a better QB, and you've seen that I have been named to the Pro Bowl for 2 straight years, so obviously I don't suck, which isn't the, you know, I think we all agree on that. Tyrod does not suck. None of us have ever said that. So, well, at least not publicly. I think during games, I think there have been Tyrod, you suck moments that we all have. But I've said the same about Jim Kelly, I'm sure, in the past too. So this gets to what should the Bills do with Tyrod? Now, we decided that we are pansies, and we don't want to answer that question yet. And actually, I shouldn't say that because we've answered it on prior podcasts and given our thoughts. All on what we do. Yes. So we're going to play this two ways. We're going to play both sides of the table on this one, like a good politician does. So, you know, the Bills have decided, you've heard it here first, and you're going to hear conflicting information about 5 minutes once we finish this topic, that the Bills will be retaining Tyrod Taylor, and they are going to move forward with that quarterback as their franchise quarterback for now. So the Bills are keeping Tyrod. Geez, what should they do now that they have signed him? For a reminder, this will give him about $30 million in guaranteed money, but only eat up about $15.9 million of the cap and leaves the Bills with some cap space potentially to sign free agents, though not all that much. So we will go to, I believe it's Scott's turn. We'll go to Scott first on this one. So, Scott, now that you know the Bills are retaining Tyrod Taylor, what should they do around him with the resources they have available?
So the biggest thing is obviously, so the Bills have a ton of, I don't say a ton of, they have a lot of free agents who are going to be free agents, and they're not going to be able to keep all of them. And obviously, if we're keeping Tyrod, then based off of LeSean for the most part, and also to a certain extent, you know, people like Kyle Williams, you know, to a lesser extent, Marshall Darius, who's obviously got more years on him than Kyle does. But you're at the point where you feel like you were pretty close to where we were last year. I mean, you were an 8-18 last year, right? 7-9, something. You were close. Close-ish. And with hopefully the defense getting better and healthier, with Shaq Lawson getting a full year and Reggie Ragland coming back theoretically for his real rookie season, and you kind of getting a bonus first-round pick out of this as a result, or second-round pick. You know, you really have to kind of be focused on winning now. So the biggest gap to me at this point on the team is frankly safety. I think Aaron Williams is just impossible to count on right now. You know, again, at this point, I just hope he doesn't come back, frankly. I loved watching him play. He was a really great player for us. He's a very smart guy. And that's one of the, you know, Rex always said that was why the defense, that was one of the things he blamed, was Aaron Williams getting injured. But frankly, it's just kind of hard to count on him at this point, making it through a whole season, because he's just, you know, I don't want to put that on him, and I can't count on him anyway. So frankly, I don't want him kind of coming back just for that. But in addition, just kind of the idea that he's going to be, you know, he's just kind of injury prone at this point with the concussion. So it's difficult to say that, but so for me, that's why I'm thinking, you know, it's definitely kind of time to find another safety. And then at the same time, how are we going to pay for him? I honestly think Stephon Gilmore is going to get a ton of money from someone, so I feel like we don't bring him back. I feel like we take that money, and maybe we make a run at Eric Berry. I'm sure he's going to take a huge number, kind of being the number one safety on the market. But I feel like if you could get a guy like him, maybe then you use your draft pick on a cornerback and kind of have Darby be the senior guy. And hopefully it's a pretty quarterback heavy draft, so hopefully you can kind of pick out a good one there. And then you kind of make your best effort to get either Zach Brown or Lorenzo Alexander to come back. I don't think you're going to get both. Obviously, Zach Brown's younger, but he's going to probably command a higher price accordingly. Lorenzo probably has fewer years left on him, and you're taking a little bit bigger risk just because the age and because of he's kind of a one-season wonder. And obviously, the Rex Ryan defense suited him very well, and it's unclear that McDermott's going to know how to use him the same way. But beyond that, I think you can lose a lot of the other free agents. So Brown or Alexander, and then you get Ragland back. That ends up stabilizing the defense along with the new corner, and then hopefully – you know, if you don't get Eric Berry, then yeah, you got to go kind of get somebody like Malik Hooker in the draft. And then on offense, you just kind of hoping, you know, maybe you spend the second or third rounder on a wide receiver and then kind of go hit the free agency market to kind of fill out your wide receiver corner, because probably not going to be able to keep Rob Lewis and, you know, Goodwin and everybody else was kind of a, you know, maybe you can keep Justin Hunter or something, but that's probably about it for how I see it playing out.
All right, Frank, now that they're keeping Tyrod, how about you? What do you think they're going
to
do?
No, I just sort of want to co-sign what Scott said, because he nailed it. I mean, there's not much else different. I think that I might put wide receiver a little higher on the list for me than the otherwise, but you're kind of doing that. And I think the other thing you do is you if you're going to keep Tyrod, then you're actually keeping Tyrod for a few years, but I think that you – owe it to yourself, if not this year, then next year, to take a quarterback in the middle rounds, just as insurance, mm-hmm. as a backup kind of situation. But I have nothing to add to Scott's presentation.
Yeah, and I don't really have too much either. I think you keep Tyrod, that's camp a lot of space. I agree on letting Gilmore walk. I think he's going to get more money than he's worth. And as we've discussed, while I believe he is a top 15 cornerback in the NFL, you will have to retain him for top five cornerback money. It's going to prevent you from doing other things which might prove more useful to your team. I have it on good authority from one of the people that works for me in D.C. that Stephon's inconsistency dates back to his time at the University of South Carolina, and that is probably not likely to change after nine seasons of general inconsistency. So always good to have people work for you who are college football fans and went to the University of South Carolina at the exact same time as Stephon Gilmore. So, I think, you know, you don't retain EJ, Percy's largely done, we think. I think that Lorenzo, I would
still done before like, the season. He never should have been re-signed.
Right. That's true. He was unretired and now essentially he's going back to retirement. I really would like them to see re-sign Felton. I think they can get him for a decent deal. It's not like he is considered a Pro Bowl fullback, but he did a very good job as a fullback. They do not want to give him the money they gave him two seasons ago, so I would like to see them try to get him an offense. I think Alexander will be difficult when you retain Tyrod because it's eating up so much space, but I think you at least make the effort there. I think you unfortunately have to give up on Robert Woods. I hate to say that. I like him. I want him to be retained. I simply don't think the money will be there. And then, yeah, I agree with Scott's draft approach and Frank's seconding of that. So this is where I normally repeat things and take up time. Instead, we'll just move on to breaking news part two. The Bills are not going to be retaining Tyrod Taylor. They have chosen to part ways with him, not pay him the $30 million, and free up $15.9 million in cap space going into the 2017 season. Now, Frank,
for a half a second, I thought you were telling me exactly what was like. You literally just got a text.
No.
I was like, what? No. Wait, we're playing the game.
Yeah, sorry, my bad. I do have the tweet deck open at all times, by the way, for our listeners. So, and I'm looking at all of the followers, and of course, there would be a lot of news if this were the case, because most people we follow are Bills related. Though I did follow ABC's Weekend Good Morning America co-host Dan Harris, whose book I read a while ago. And then when my wife and I were drinking on Saturday night, I tweeted at him and told him that I think when Alex retires, he's going to make an excellent host for Jeopardy. And I woke up the next morning with a headache, but with a love, if you will, a heart sign by Dan Harris. So it's mainly who we follow is Dan Harris and Bills fans and Bills reporters and so forth. So with that one exception, there is no actual real breaking news. But in this fake world, the Bills are not retaining Tyrod. Frank, what is your take here on what they should do now? Now they have $15.9 million cap space, but no quarterback on the roster.
In the alternate sliding doors universe where Gwyneth Paltrow doesn't make the train, and what happens to her subsequently. I think that this requires a little further caveat, because I think I'd like to also rule out that we would go the Tony Romo route at this point.
That's fine. I'll stipulate to that.
Okay. Yeah. Then in that case, I think what happens is there's not a lot of good quarterbacks left in the market, and I think you draft Deshaun Watson with the 10th overall pick if he's there. And you build. You start over. And the other thing you do is you trade LeSean McCoy if you can. Because he is – not because he's finishing the bottom of the Super Bowl there, somebody. He's going to make $8 million next year, which isn't terrible per se, and you would actually lose a lot of it in dead cap money. But he deserves to be on a team that's better than the Bills in what would ostensibly be a bit of a rebuild project here. By the time you're going young, but I would expect that. I would expect them to draft a quarterback early. I would expect them to sign a veteran journeyman quarterback, and I would expect them to move on from a couple of players that have some value. That's what I would do. I would try and find a draft pick that I could get for LeSean McCoy, and I would say now I have $24 million in cap space plus the $15 million or $16 million I'm not spending on Tyrod Taylor, and I need to take that money, and I need to now. I do need to go after somebody like Eric Berry, and roll that into there and build up some other part of the team, and hope that we've worked out the quarterback appropriately. I would not be opposed to drafting two quarterbacks if that's the case, because that's kind of what I think the final is. Solution. Wow, the final solution. That's actually a poor phrase.
Oh dear.
But the final end of the.
It's a good thing you'll edit this podcast later.
No, so. I won't. That's what the end game needs to be. Is you don't think he's the quarterback, so you need one, and if you need one, there's no time like the present to start to keep trying. So, that's what I would do. I would move on from a couple of.
All right, yeah. So it's a full burn it down then.
It's a half burn it down. To me, McCoy and I guess depending on what other people want, like I wouldn't like miss Charles Clay per se, but it would depend on what I could get back for those guys, and I would want to at least I would want the Bills to at least be exploring the opportunity to get rid of some of these people and starting over.
But then all the free agents then aren't coming back, basically, is what you're saying. So Gilmore, Woods, Alexander, Brown.
Yeah, I'm right. Woods is a guy that maybe I would resign because now he's going to be affordable and maybe you want wide receivers there. It's a little.
He's still pretty young. I mean, he's
yeah. 20, so. But you know, like I don't want aging guys in their last couple of years of production because I'm expecting the next year or two to be iffy. And frankly, running back should be easy to find. And not so, LeSean McCoy good, but you should be able to find a guy who can run the football.
I agree. I mean, and Gillis Lee can at least run the football, frankly.
Right. Gillis Lee is already on the team.
Can't do as much of that as of the other stuff that McCoy does. But
right.
So, and then just so I know, your theory then is we take a step back this year and then...
Yeah, the theory is
way
that
better next year, or just
well, you the theory better. Is you have a defensive coach, and so you give him that time. You need a quarterback, but you give him the rest of the resources to hopefully build up the defense, and then you're maybe Dallas, right? And you get a little lucky, and you have a quarterback who plays a little bit better than you expected, and you have a good defense, and you're on a roll. But I mean, if you're not going to keep Tyrod, then you're sort of you know, spitting in the face of this 7-9 win football team, and that's fine. But you know, go for the gusto then. Don't hold back.
Wait, so, okay, so just to be clear, so then you're saying we don't sign any of the current free agents, and then we're basically waiting a year to invest all the big money on defense, or we just invest all the big money on defense now?
You can start investing in the defense now. Like I said, if Eric Berry is a guy that is going to really work, go for it. If, you know, that's a lot of money for a safety in my mind, but like, you know, if you want to, you know, you could also hold back. You could also hold back and wait another year. But what I don't want to do is the time. The only people that are really wasting my time are people that are in like their last 1 to 2 years of production. So it should be about getting young, good players. And to me, Berry is a young enough, good player that he's not in his last couple of years of production. And so he sort of fits my mold. Same with Woods. Woods is a young receiver who's pretty good and fits my mold that like you could sign him for a few years and he'd probably be good depending on how well your quarterback is playing.
Yeah. Okay. All right. No, that's interesting. Yeah, no, I think mine is a little bit similar. I mean, I definitely realize, yeah, I mean, if we're not keeping Tyrod, then yeah, there is obviously going to be a cap on how much we win this year on some level. And so my plan would be kind of, yeah, you take a step, you're admitting that you're taking a little bit of a step back this year. Obviously, you can't do that publicly because you can't ever admit that you're not trying to win. Mm-hmm. But, you know, theoretically, then maybe, yeah, you get back to where we were last year, 2016, next year, and then the year after that, you're now set up to really kind of be in a position to have a good kind of 4 or 5 year run, hopefully with a good, with a good core. So with that in mind, yeah, I mean, definitely, you know, Gilmore's gone. Zach Brown is 27. So he's kind of a guy that you'd really have to think about maybe trying to keep. Sure. I don't want to burn down the whole defense. And, you know, Darius is not like, not exactly like the leader that I'm looking for on my defense going forward. Right. So I would be a little concerned about having him being like the highest paid guy, though obviously he kind of will be the highest paid guy regardless of what we play Zach Brown, because it's not going to be what Darius is getting. But you kind of want to keep a little bit of the team intact. And obviously Raglan's kind of brand new, so we don't know what we're going to get with him. And obviously so is Lawson. So, you know, I think maybe you try and make a pitch to keep Zach Brown, and he didn't do too bad this year. But then on offense, yeah, I mean, I think in the offense side, then I wonder, I guess it does make sense to just try and take a quarterback with the 10 pick, because it is such a, your odds of winning go way down, or getting lucky go way down if you get much further. Part of me thinks that if we're going to kind of let everybody go, then maybe we should go for wide receiver or something. But honestly, I guess it should really just be quarterback. And then beyond that, then I don't trade LeSean. I think LeSean's got a couple more years left on him that he could still be good. And I feel like you can design an offense that to a certain extent accentuates whatever your quarterback's, you know, one or two strengths are, and then have everything else run through LeSean. And then that'll keep you at least somewhat competitive in some of these games, kind of while you're still in these semi-rebuilding modes, that you're not that far away. But the other thing I would invest in is the line, and try and figure out, you know, a tackle or somebody to kind of take Jordan Mills' spot, because I think that was the one thing that Prescott had this year that everyone else didn't to a certain extent, is the, you know, just the absolute solid offensive line, and then in addition to kind of the number of weapons that he had. So I think that would be the plan. I'd still be worried about wide receiver in that scenario, as is obviously the rest of the defense. But I think you can kind of pick up some guys in the draft in the later rounds to hopefully help you out there.
And I, you know, this I'm with Frank on what I would call the half burn it down sort of deal too. I might actually try to trade McCoy, because I feel like if they won't be competitive next year, he'll likely get into his mid to late 30s. You will have to, you know, let me try that nonsense. His age will start to get up there. And as his age starts to get up there, his performance will likely decline. I don't know if he has that many good years. If you can find a team, and you need a few things here, you need, with cap space, a team that feels it's going to be competitive, and a team that has a need in the running game, and you feel you can get a good return on that, that's not a bad decision to make. I think you can probably retain Robert Woods, because he's still young. You know, he's got some years left in him. You can still have, you know, if you're going to look to retain Watkins down the road, you'll have two solid receivers. You can draft receivers. You can build around that. You'll still have some offensive linemen. You could at least be you could at least field a capable team next year on that side. The defense is going to be, I think no matter which Tyrod snare we choose, this defensive snare is going to be a mess. They've got a lot of overpaid talent, some of which is on contract for a number of years still. The only one who really lived up to their contract this past year was Kyle Williams, who will probably retire if, in fact, the Bills choose to go the non-Tyrod route. So we will see if that report is accurate. So I think it's going to be very difficult for them to compete even for a wild card without Tyrod Taylor. I think without a clear successor for Taylor, and if they can't get a Tony Romo type person, they really are going to have to look to rebuild. Not a Browns rebuild, because who knows what that will entail. The whole tanking and compiling a lot of picks, but risking the creation of a losing culture in order to do so that you don't have to try and get out of. It's a risky proposition. So I am fine if a 4-12 season results and they've retained some younger talent. And I would be okay with that if, in fact, they don't decide to keep Tyrod and, in fact, then cannot get a Tony Romo or someone similar off the market. So speaking of things that are discussed on Slew News Days, this day in Bill's history is just this is ridiculous. Find things that have happened for me on Bill's history on February 8th. That is an open challenge to everyone. Let's read some headlines. The Miami Dolphins, Ayn Ruben Brown, February 8th, 2000. Same day. Oh, this was scarily prescient. Thurman Thomas, Andre Reed, maybe salary cap casualties. Oh, Rochester Democrat and Chronicle, you were remarkably on point on that very tragic news. 2001, cuts expected as Bills tackle salary cap woes. Suspect arrested in a hijacking of Buffalo Bills player, which I did not know that Rayon Hill had ever gotten hijacked. Rayon is fine now, so I'm glad he got through that. Bills name, Bills name, Fred Graves, receivers coach. Our this day in Bills history will, in fact, come from 2001. But I'm going to play up some of the other crap that happened on this day as well. Tom Modrak on the Falcons list for general manager in 2002. Greg Williams is close to a decision on an offensive coordinator. If you want to go to 2003, you'll find even more layers of crap. The Patriots declined to exercise the option on Antoine Smith. That ended that former Bills player's career. The Bills are putting in some new turf. And then the last year I looked up before I gave up and just called it a crap of a day. February 8th, 2005. BuffaloBills.com reported that the Bills have formed a memorabilia collectors club, the Bills Archives Department. So that's
fantastic.
Yeah. During the regular season, the This Days in Bills histories write themselves, and we have a lot of fun with them. So what I had to do this time is go to February 8th, 2001. This is, so we're going back 16 years, and it is a Greg Williams radio interview. And this 20 minutes. It was defined as a must listen. And what scares me is the number of things that sound vaguely familiar. So as we look into this, Coach Williams' first comments regarding the issue paramount in both Bills and most Bills fans' mind: who's the quarterback? Oh, it's weird that people ever discuss that with the Bills. Said no decision has been made, and a process on continual evaluation is ongoing, but there will be a decision by March 1st. I want men to be treated like men. I want people to talk face-to-face. I want to start fair with all parties. So Williams had to praise the background of a questionable offensive coordinator in Mike Shepard, but noticed that he organized an approach, an attacking approach, and they learned from the likes of Marsha Broda, Gilbride, and Holmgren. Interesting that they're quoting someone who, as an offensive coordinator, was not very successful, but learned from some very good minds that had some good players playing for them. He talked about the having a passing game that sets up the power running game opportunities. This is the only thing that's really different is to the Bills now. Now they are trying to use the power running game to set up a passing game in this instance. So, that is something that, is different from back then. So this will be the source of our trivia question, what's coming up. It says, Coach Williams wants his coaching staff assembled and in place by Sunday when they will gather in Buffalo. He said there still may be a vacancy but didn't elaborate which one. There have been discussions on this former Bills quarterback taking a role in the organization as a coach.
Yep.
Can you name February, the former quarterback named by Greg Williams who might join the organization as a coach?
There are only two quarterbacks that ever get named as possible people who came back to be coaches. One is Alex Van Pelt, and the other one is my choice. I'm going to say this was the beginning of Frank Reich possibly coming back to be a coach.
And all right. What do you think? Frank's very correct. It is, there is only two quarterbacks that do come up, and I will pick the other one, which is Sun Tzu. Mm.
Old number six.
You know, again, he was a smart, that's the thing. He was a coach. You could see that even when he was playing. Mm-hmm. Like, he was always one step ahead of the opposition, you know, a lot of deep thoughts. You know, he had all those sayings about, you know thy enemy and you'll be the master of, you know, but know, you know, you'll beat them in one battle, but know thyself, you'll be the master of all the battles. And, you know, never take the field of battle until you, you know, a victory is already assured.
Which, you know, that led to a lot of delay of games, though, when he would do that, because he would knock it out of the field.
But you can, but that's the thing. It worked.
Took a lot of sacks, too. Right.
It worked. That's the thing. That's why he ended up coming back to coach that year. I think did they end up signing Frank or Paul? I should say
they did not. You know, they were realizing that, well, you know, the art of war saw practical use in Western society. They made the ultimate decision that it did not have practical use in the West Coast offense. So, you know, there was definitely some discussion. He was seriously considered, but not in fact.
I think he was hired. He was the Jaguars' strength and conditioning coach for a while.
And he was a strong guy. I mean, all you have to do is the bust of this guy online, and you will find that you know, this is a broad-shouldered individual.
You know, wiry.
Right. And of course, in addition to Sun Tzu, strong considered, there was another Bills quarterback who was considered for a role, did not in fact get the role, and that would be Joe Ferguson. He would
Frank Reich before Frank Reich.
Yep. So he was considered for a position, didn't get it. Actually, did not end up being a coach in the NFL at any point in time. You may remember he had a battle with Burkitt's lymphoma cancer. You know, about 12 years ago, he had like leukemia and all of those things. Really, every cancer he basically had.
Jeez.
But you know, 8 years ago, it was reported that he had recovered from his battles from cancer, and there. As of this writing, as of this discussion, no recurrence. You know, he's been interviewed very recently as well. So, you know, he's one of those guys. Surviving leukemia is not easy. So this was a tough SOB. And he was considered for a spot on the Bills coaching staff on this day, February 8th, 2001. And I cannot wait till our next podcast when hopefully at least roster moves will have been made that I can discuss instead.
I was gonna say Alex Van Pelt, but then I was like, wait, no, he was actually probably still on the team in 2001, frankly.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to suss out, with whether he was still quarterback in 2001 somewhere.
I think he was done by then, but I don't think he was in the coaching. I think he was in that tweener phase here. Let's see when he finished his career in 1998 with the Lions, and he didn't start as a coach until 2008. So yeah, he was. I wonder what he was doing in 2000. In one, he was a Christian guy, so he probably wasn't doing a lot of, you know, drugs and hookers. I would guess.
But no, they said he was. It says here he was on the Buffalo Bills from 1994 to 2003. That's Wikipedia.
1994. After retiring in 2004.
Tim Pelt's first win as a starter came in 1997 against San Marino and the Miami Dolphins. In 2001, he started 8 games, going 2-6, and playing well enough to justify a contract extension that would allow the Bills to release failed Doug Flutie successor Rob Johnson. Van Pelt would never start a game after 2001 due to the Bills' trade with the New England Patriots for Drew Bledsoe, who became the full-time starting quarterback.
I was talking about Frank Reich. Okay, that's where I confused.
Van Pelt remained with the team as Bledsoe's backup for the next 2 seasons before retiring. Then he coached the Frankfurt Galaxy in 2005 and came back to the Buffalo Bills as an offensive quality coach, a quarterback coach, and then as a offensive coordinator in 2009. So there you go.
Yep, that was after the firing of the Turk that he took over for the Bills in his only offensive coordinator role. Turk Schoenert. I don't think we have much on Facebook and Twitter. I will quickly go over Twitter if someone wants to pull up. I believe we have one.
No, nothing on Facebook.
All right, nothing really on Twitter, too.
Brian did chime in, but there was no question. It was just agreeing that. Mm-hmm.
Terrible. Mm-hmm. Yep. We thank Brian for knowing as a Bills fan. Often the only enjoyable part of the season is the weekly At the Bills MNY podcast/therapy session. And he tweeted that to Liz, NFL Girl UK, on we'd love your thoughts on the best NFL podcast in the US. So we tip our caps. Caps to Brian. So thanks for helping us out the shout there. I noted on Twitter, and this was liked by multiple people, I'm not so much upset with the games. I am fearful of the level of obnoxiousness Pats fans will hit if New England wins. And Ryan said, I'd give anything not to have to listen to your shitty president and the shitty Pats fans. Thanks for nothing, Atlanta. So that was Ryan's view. Go Red Blacks. Let's see. So let's see. And yeah, that's it. Wow. So this is what happens in the dead of winter. But we got over an hour out of this podcast. So we did.
I don't know if it's good that we got over an hour. I don't know if that should have been our goal, Paul. But
I think it's okay. Good because I think except for the BS at the beginning and the last like 5 minutes of useless this day in Bills history and Facebook and Twitter feedback.
And the 45 minutes in between.
Yeah,
I think there was relative substance. I mean, if you stopped listening by now, the better for you. If you skip through the intro, even better. Right. Yeah. That really would apply every week. If you skip through the intro and you skip through the things we're doing at the end, you're probably going to get a good podcast. And if you like this podcast, we encourage you to share this podcast. You can find Scott and occasionally Frank on Facebook at bbillsmny/facebook.com. I am on Twitter at bbillsmny /twitter.com/bbillsmny. Yes, I understand how the World Wide Web works. You can simply Google Buffalo Bills podcast and you will find us. Let's take a look. Still number 4, Bills and Beers, Rock Pile Report, the John Murphy Show official podcast, and us. So, thank you for continuing to listen to us. You can also find us on iTunes, of course. We will be back sometime between 2 and 10 weeks, I would imagine. Probably not as long as 10. Yeah,
I would, unless something big happens, I would say don't expect to hear from us till March.
Yeah,
the Tyrod decision would be the next.
Yeah,
one.
Right.
Right.
And we will know what happens with Tyrod, and we will have a Tyrod cast.
We'll try and break down the NFL Combine for you when that happens too.
Yep. And so this means we've almost hit the 5-year mark. We started this, I believe, in mid to late March of 2012. So we will. Our next episode or the one thereafter will be our season finale before we move on to season 6. So thank you for almost making it through 5 full seasons, for dealing with my convoluted intro, and to deal with the nonsense all here at the end. But until next time, I'm Paul.
Got.
I'm Frank.
See you guys next time.